From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Our first two interviews are about facts. Facts that have political resonance and consequences and are elusive. First, facts about drone strikes. The Obama administration has long been known to be hitting al-Qaeda with drones in Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, and Afghanistan. But the government rarely releases death tolls in these strikes, and even more rarely, information on civilian casualties. Questions arise even when numbers are supplied. On Tuesday, a piece in the New York Times by Scott Shane and Joe Becker reported that, according to several administration sources, the government considers, quote, all military-age males in a strike zone as combatants, unless there is explicit intelligence posthumously proving them innocent. Chris Woods is senior reporter for the Bureau of Investigative Journalism in the UK. Since 2010, he's worked to confirm and map civilian deaths from drone strikes and covert actions in the Middle East and Africa. In February, his group released findings that conflicted with those of the CIA. U.S. officials accused Woods' group of being played by militants and Pakistani intelligence. Woods says the charge is absurd.
We take our information from a huge variety of sources, including U.S. media and from leaked intelligence documents and from U.S. intelligence officials themselves on occasion when they speak to us. We speak to an enormous array of sources. Among those sources, for example, Pakistani lawyers representing civilians killed in the drone strikes over in Pakistan. One of those lawyers, U.S. intelligence officials have labeled as an agent of Pakistani intelligence. I think that's an absolutely laughable claim. And unfortunately, an indication of the extent to which the U.S. intelligence community seems prepared to go to ridicule claims of civilian casualties in Pakistan and elsewhere. Our view is that instead of knocking down the messenger, we think that the CIA should be looking into those cases and making a decision about whether civilians actually died or not.
So you don't see any cases in which the U.S. government is doing that? The president's national security advisor says that the president is very closely involved in the decisions when it comes to these drone strikes, and the reason is to feel comfortable that civilians won't be inadvertently targeted.
Well, let's be absolutely clear. The CIA claimed that between May 2010 and at least September 2011, as possibly right up to today, they haven't killed a single civilian in Pakistan. Now, it is absolutely fair to say that particularly since late 2010, the proportion of civilians killed in U.S. drone strikes has fallen, and that's absolutely demonstrable from the data that we collate. Unfortunately, as far as the CIA is concerned, it hasn't killed any civilians.
You have noted that American media, when it comes to these drone strikes, do a poor job of reporting on, quote, collateral damage.
There have been 17 CIA drone strikes in Pakistan in 2012. In only two of them have civilians credibly been reported as killed. And as far as I can tell, neither of those occasions were those civilian deaths reported in the United States. And we've seen that many times over. There are very big reports about particular named militants killed. But when civilians are unfortunately killed, we seem to have this discord between what's being reported internationally and what's being reported within the United States. And I do wonder at that.
Just to be clear, among 17 drone strikes in Pakistan
in 2012, yeah.
In 2012, two have reportedly involved the death of civilians reported all around the world except in the U.S. I wish we had a larger pool with which to indict the American press.
Let's cut back to what this is about. When you're a news editor and you're deciding what information you're going to give, why are other media doing something that the U.S. media apparently isn't? And I think that is a valid question.
Do you have an answer?
I think a lot of the reporting that takes place in the United States on drone-related matters is by national security correspondents. And there is a narrative in Washington that says that drones are a good thing and that reports of civilian deaths are exaggerated or are propaganda from militants, and I've heard that many times. you know, ultimately, as we've seen multiple intelligence leaks from administration figures, from agency figures, this is a rewards-based system. And if you annoy the intelligence community or you annoy your sources in the White House, you don't get the goodies. And remember, for 6 months, the claims by senior intelligence officials in the U.S. that they weren't killing civilians in Pakistan went completely untested in the United States. It took ourselves doing an investigation in July of last year to actually challenge that claim, which, as I say, had gone on for 7 months unchallenged by the U.S. media.
What are the stakes, do you think, for American news consumers? Why do they need to know this?
By repeating the message that no civilians are dying in places like Pakistan, we tell ourselves that the drone campaign is successful, and then we start using more drones. But back on the ground in Pakistan, resentment towards the United States builds and builds. But I think more broadly, given that we're talking about a policy of effectively of targeted killing, somewhere in the region of 3,000 people have died in covert U.S. drone strikes, we have to be sure that what we're doing is the best policy and that the longer-term consequences of that aren't going to come back and haunt us.
Chris, thank you very much.
A real pleasure.
Chris Woods is senior reporter for the UK-based Bureau of Investigative Journalism. Next, facts about rape. Recently, Senator Joseph Lieberman wrote an op-ed for the Washington Post laying out reasons for the U.S. to support the Syrian resistance and oppose the Syrian government. Among them, he described, quote, the widespread and deliberate use of rape and other sexual violence as weapons of war. Lauren Wolf is the director of the Women Under Siege Project, which has curated a map plotting cases of sexual violence in Syria. After reading the senator's claim in the Post, she wrote an article about trying to verify his assertions of widespread rape. It was a strange thing to do, publicly casting doubt on assertions that support your cause. But she concluded that ultimately, credibility is more important.
To me, it actually reminds me of the weapons of mass destruction controversy. If you're going to be saying there's widespread human rights abuses, sexual violence, and then it turns out not to be the case, and in the meantime, that's how we've built up the premise of getting involved in a foreign war, we should be very careful at the beginning when we start saying these things.
Now, you aren't saying that rape isn't going on. You know that rape is going on. It's just a different thing from the widespread and deliberate use of rape and other sexual violence as weapons of war.
Right. And part of the reason my project was founded, it was founded by Gloria Steinem, because she wanted to understand better how rape is literally used as a weapon of war in each conflict. And if you understand it's being used to gain information about combatants who are related to these women, if you understand that it's being used for ethnic cleansing in order to forcibly impregnate women, as they were in Bosnia, sometimes it's used for humiliation, just a means of terrorizing a population. Once you have a better grasp on why it's being used, then perhaps you can intercede.
And what do you know about Syria? Why did the red flag go up?
From what we're seeing, there are rapes of women at checkpoints where cars come to a checkpoint, the police enter, pull out the men, enter the car and rape the women. We're also hearing about rape in detention. The third way that we've heard about is through a mass incident. Say there's a bombing by the army. Then the Shabiha, the plainclothes military forces, come in, loot the houses, and rape the women. And we've heard multiple instances of this happening. And in fact, when we're mapping these instances, I have to stop sometimes and say, you know what, this report sounds a lot like that report that we already have. And it's the kind of thing where you're in an echo chamber and you're trying to sort out what's what. Information is coming out, but it's coming out with agendas attached to it. And there's nothing more propagandistic than saying, you know what, the opposing side is brutalizing our women. What we have to do is try to triangulate and verify. So I'm working with Physicians for Human Rights and a team of epidemiologists at Columbia. What we're doing is marking down all the reports as unverified. And the hope is as things calm down, we'll be able to figure out which ones might have happened and which ones were really just false.
Are you worried that you're undercutting your own advocacy?
Yes. And in fact, I debated whether to publish this piece at all. I wrote it in a fit of frustration.
Have you been criticized?
Yes, we've gotten a couple of emails and comments. I believe they're Syrians, they're activists, and they say, you know, you're casting doubt at a moment that it's not necessary to do so. You should be sending support. They only want us to be criticizing the Syrian army.
It's particularly hard to track and map rape, isn't it? Because the victims are often unwilling to tell you about it.
They have so many reasons to not come forward. In places like the Middle East, you're not just shunned, you're disowned by your whole family. What reason would you have to come forward, especially when there's no justice to be had? But when a woman does, there's probably 10 more behind her who found all those reasons not to come forward and didn't. So it really is important that each time we get a report like this, we can draw from it that there's a real underreporting problem. So what's interesting in reporting Syria is you're balancing that with the possibility of overreporting.
Tell me about Women Under Siege's map.
We put together a team of epidemiologists, Syrian activists, and what we've done is put it out to the world with different ways that people can report. They can come directly to the site, fill out a form. They can email us, or they can use a Twitter hashtag, Rape in Syria. What it's doing is it's tracking perpetrators. So we have it broken down by, is it the Shabiha? Is it the government forces, non-government? What kinds of acts?
When you're talking to reporters who cover this issue, where do they get their information?
Most of them are getting them the way we are in our project, which is really secondhand and thirdhand. It can make for a nightmare of verification. I've talked to people at major news outlets who say, you know, we're running with this, but we really can't know. And I say, well, I have the luxury of writing it on this map I have and marking it unverified. You don't. So we go back and forth and we share stories and we try to understand the basics of, you know, does this fit into a particular pattern? Can we weed this out? But I feel for them. It's an extremely difficult thing to have to put your news organization's name on when it really could just be rumor, propaganda, or lies.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lauren Wolf is the director of Women Under Siege, part of the Women's Media Center.
Coming up, will Google go the way of Teflon and cellophane?
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. So there you are, sometime later this year, watching the 2012 remake of Red Dawn. You might recall that the 1984 original told the story of some plucky American high school students who fend off an invasion by the Russians.
This is the emergency broadcast system. We are under attack by conventional forces of the Russian army. Communications have broken down in other parts of the country. Large areas of the Midwest may have been overrun.
In the 2012 remake, the invaders won't be Russian. They'll be North Korean. What you'll unwittingly be watching is actually one of the many ways that Hollywood is, you'll pardon the expression, kowtowing to the Chinese. Stanley Rosen, a professor of political science at the University of Southern California, is a longtime watcher of Hollywood and its relationship with China, and he joins us now. Stanley, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Happy to be here.
So let's start with Red Dawn 2012. The invaders are North Korean, and this has to do with China. How?
Originally, the plan was to have the invaders be Chinese, and in fact, it was done with them speaking Chinese until somebody told the filmmakers that, you know, that might not be a good idea since China now has the second largest film market in the world, and you may want to play this film there. So they spent, as I understand it, about $1 million to digitally change what needed to be changed in terms of the language, in terms of some of the insignias on the uniforms and so on, so that China would be a minor character.
There are, as it turns out, many red lines for story content for U.S. films going to China. And some of them are just bizarre. You can't have time travel in a movie?
That's actually changing a bit, but in general, yes, it goes back in some ways to Chinese tradition. When you couldn't criticize what was going on in the present, you set the action in the past. People would understand what they're really doing is criticizing the corruption going on in the present. Science fiction at one point was a red line. Superstition was a red line. But when you have films like Harry Potter, now Men in Black 3, you know, the first Men in Black was banned in China. The second Men in Black wasn't even submitted to be shown in China, but Men in Black 3 was allowed. So the red lines are changing. Certainly too much violence, sex, anything at all possibly that could be construed as critical of China and also critical of other countries that China wants to be on good terms with. One example, Pirates of the Caribbean, when Chow Yun-fat played a pirate in Singapore, his opening line was,
"Captain Barbosa, welcome to Singapore."
That was eliminated because the government felt that people would get the idea that Singapore was a den of pirates. Some of it's quite ludicrous.
There was a time in the 80s and the 90s when the plight of Tibet was a favorite Hollywood subject.
Mm-hmm. Back in the late 90s with 7 Years in Tibet, Kundun, Martin Scorsese's film, Red Corner, about the Chinese legal system, the Richard Gere film. All three films came out around the same time, and all those studios were banned for a number of years from distributing movies in China. But in those days, studios could feel free to make films that might be unappetizing to China. Now it's the opposite. Pandering, perhaps, would be a word. Take a movie like 2012, which was a big hit in China. In it, when they build the arcs to save the world, Oliver Platt, one of the characters, says,
"Leave it to the Chinese. I didn't think it was possible. Not in the time we had."
When they land in China after escaping from North America, which is being destroyed by natural disasters, People's Liberation Army greets the group coming, salutes, and says, "Welcome to China." And you know, in Shanghai, in the audience, in one of the theaters, everybody stood up and applauded.
Are the stakes that high to prompt Hollywood to be so subservient?
Hollywood, as you know, is always concerned with the bottom line, not concerned with politics. They can be embarrassed. They have been in a number of cases recently. One of the production companies, Legendary, was making a film in China in the very county where Chen Guangcheng, the blind activist, was being housed and brutalized. They didn't realize. They were praising the local officials as to how cooperative they were.
It's not just content we're speaking of. There's an ongoing Securities and Exchange Commission investigation of bribes possibly paid by Hollywood studios to secure distribution or financing or filming rights in China. Are these content concessions related to that activity as well?
They're certainly related to the fact that there's been a quota in place. It used to be 10 international films a year, then it went up to 20. Now there's an additional 14 more 3D and IMAX films. So the studios are very much trying to get their numbers within that quota. If you invite some leading official in the Chinese film industry to visit Hollywood, all expenses paid, to discuss negotiations on this, that, or the other thing, if you help a son or daughter do their application for an American university, at what point does quote-unquote friendship and being helpful cross the line into actually being a bribe?
You mentioned the quotas. There is now a maximum of 34 films, which does not seem like a huge number on the face of it. Tell me how significant those 34 films are to the overall economics of Hollywood and its future.
Hollywood makes about 5% of its box office in China on average. But China is seen as a growing market, growing over 30% a year, whereas the North American box office has been pretty stagnant by and large. China's also building large numbers of new screens. Every week, the top film at the box office in China has been a Hollywood film. 64% of the box office this year in China has been Hollywood films. Since February, it's 77%.
Finally, let's just say for a moment that the sort of self-censorship you described with Red Dawn and other content is morally contemptible. Let's just say. Does it matter? Are there consequences?
In a perverse way, it matters in a positive way, because there's a lot of feeling in China that in foreign policy, the United States is doing its best to be the policeman of the world and to keep China weak. Hollywood films that make China look good, in fact, help America's soft power. Almost the opposite of what you're suggesting, I think an argument could be made that by doing what they're doing, Hollywood is actually building a stronger set of feelings toward the United States than if they were showing China in a very negative light.
Stanley, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Stanley Rosen is a professor of political science at the University of Southern California.
Weibo is China's most popular social networking site, home to 324 million users, frequently referred to as China's Twitter, and it's desperately seeking censors. Seems the currently rumored 1,000 censors just isn't enough. Jacob Weisberg, chairman of the Slate Group, visited Weibo's offices last week. He wrote that, quote, "The Chinese government's can't live with it, can't live without it relationship to Weibo epitomizes the paradoxical condition of free expression in China."
There's a genie that's out of the bottle here. People love it. I also think it's useful to the government in certain ways. How do you stay in touch with public sentiment in a country that doesn't have free expression, where there's not a democracy? How do you take the pulse? How do you know how much jeopardy you're in? And I think social media is a prime way that the government sort of measures public sentiment. The latest thing is they're instituting a point system on Weibo. You start with 80 points, and if you get down to 0 points, your account is suspended for some period of time. And if you get higher, I don't know, you can win valuable prizes.
So how do you earn points?
By posting in a constructive way, not being critical. You lose points for spreading rumors, whether the rumors are true or not. I mean, the Boji Lai story, which is the biggest political story to hit China probably in several years.
This is the official whose wife was implicated in the murder of a British businessman.
Right. And it was at first completely suppressed from the official press. And most people in China found out about it through these rumors, which in that case mostly turned out to be true. So there's this constant question if you're a Chinese internet user. You don't know where the boundaries are, what you can get away with. People are constantly playing games with the censorship and pushing the boundaries. They can't refer to June 4th, which is the date of Tiananmen Square, so they'll refer to May 35th. People's names are banned. They'll use a rhyme, almost like Cockney rhyming slang for the name.
What else do they do?
Another woman who I probably shouldn't name, but who has a very big following on Weibo, 4 or 5 or 6 million people. And she says someone actually at Sina, the company that runs the biggest Weibo, will call her up and sort of say, that's enough for today. And remember, Sina, the company, which is, I guess you could analogize to Twitter, is in a tricky position because they don't necessarily like or favor censorship. They're afraid of the government. And it's never clear how much is being imposed upon them and how much they're imposing on users.
Weibo refers to the kind of platform it is, the Twitter-ish platform. But Sina is the biggest provider of this platform. There are other Chinese Twitters about.
There are other Weibos in it. And it's important to understand it's a little different from Twitter, partly because in China, it's 140 characters. And a character is more like a word. If you have 140 characters, you can say a lot more.
You also met with Ai Weiwei, an artist who's become internationally famous for his provocations, starting with questions that he raised in connection with the 2008 Sichuan earthquake.
Yes, Ai Weiwei, who was a sculptor and started to become very political when he got involved in documenting the names of the children who were killed in the earthquake and the shoddy construction methods. And he became very active on social media. But in his case, it was on Twitter itself, tweeting in Chinese, but using Twitter, which you can access going around the Great Firewall, which blocks websites that the government doesn't like, using something called a proxy server. Ai Weiwei was arrested in 2011, kind of trumped up tax charges. He was detained for 81 days, and they let him out and put a number of conditions on his release. One of them was that he stop using Twitter. He completely defied that.
I read in your article that he's posted 70,000 tweets.
Well, he considers it an art form. He said that Twitter is his art in language form.
But since his imprisonment, he didn't just use words. He also turned surveillance cameras on himself and posted that video continuously online.
The government has put him under this intense surveillance. If you go to his home and studio in Beijing, you see these cameras that they've put looking down on him. He's being watched all the time. He said, what if I put myself under surveillance? And he planted his own cameras around his home. And there was a website where you could go watch in real time, this Ai Weiwei camp. And the government got really upset about that. He said they begged him to stop, I think because it was so undermining of their authority, basically because it was making fun of them.
There's nothing worse than humor.
I mean, other people play this cat and mouse game. Ai Weiwei is more known for his famous gesture of giving them the middle finger. I just read this other account about something that happened recently where he went up to these two monitors who were following him in the park taking pictures, grabbed this guy's camera, ripped out the memory card, and they ended up in the police station. And as he described it, this government agent ended up in tears saying, "Don't you understand how hard my job is?"
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Brooke. Pleasure talking to you.
Jacob Weisberg is chairman of the Slate Group.
There's a man in Arizona who really loves the word Google. Last month, he filed a legal challenge to Google's trademark, arguing that its ubiquity had turned Google into a verb. The same man had earlier lost a case when he was sued by Google for infringing on its trademark on some 750 websites, such as googlegaycruises.com. Jessica Littman, a professor at the University of Michigan, says Google may retain its trademark for now, but genericide may still be in its future. After all, many familiar products were once brand names.
Teflon, escalator, cellophane, shredded wheat was once a trademark. It's not necessarily a tragedy. Lots of companies have continued to earn a great deal of money despite losing their trademark.
This issue seems to be the ultimate good news, bad news joke. The good news is, congratulations, Google. You are synonymous with internet search. This gives you a huge competitive advantage. And the bad news is,
if consumers think that all internet search engines are Google's, and Googling is what you do when you use Bing or Yahoo Search or some other search, then that word ceases to have trademark significance and becomes the generic word for an internet search engine.
When a brand name does become genericized, or when it's verging on that, brands tend to do something which seems so awkward. They start calling themselves Coke brand or brand Coke, and other language that nobody uses in the actual galaxy. There was one case with Johnson & Johnson and Band-Aids. They took the slogan, "I'm stuck on Band-Aid," and changed it to, "I'm stuck on Band-Aid brand."
I'm stuck on Band-Aid brand because Band-Aid's stuck on me.
Moms trust Band-Aid brand to heal the hurt better than store brands.
I'm stuck on Band-Aid brand because Band-Aid.
One of the most persuasive pieces of evidence that a mark has either become generic or is in danger is when you hear people talking about Royal brand Jell-O, Curad brand Band-Aids, Puffs brand Kleenex, then you know that at least that consumer understands the brand name as a generic term for the whole product category. The policy of underlying genericide is really consumer protective. If they understand a word as a brand name, then letting someone else use it will confuse them. If, on the other hand, they understand it as the name for the kind of product, then if we don't let competitors use that word, they won't be able to communicate to consumers that they're a different brand of that product.
Back in the day, I used to get a lot of letters as a reporter, let's say from the Xerox Corporation, that said, "We detected that you used Xerox lowercase to talk about photocopying. Let us remind you that Xerox is the trademark property, blah, 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 blah. Don't do this anymore or we will send people out and kill you." I don't remember the details, but it was sharply worded. I haven't gotten one of those in decades.
Well, it's not illegal for you to use Xerox to mean photocopying or realtor to mean real estate agent. None of that is actionable. Companies send those letters to frighten people. But as the internet enabled people to publicize their overstepping cease and desist letters, companies discovered they got some bad press from sending them out too promiscuously, and I think they've cut back.
Our producer, Chris Neary, likes the idea that brands can become like rock stars. They become so big and famous as to ultimately destroy themselves One of them is aspirin. It used to be owned lock, stock, and barrel by the Bayer Company, and then they blew it.
Aspirin was interested in selling aspirin tablets to anyone who wanted to buy them and resell them to the consumer. So they licensed their product to pharmacies, to other drug manufacturers, and all of them put aspirin on the bottles, but they also put their own names on the bottles. And consumers, quite understandably, came to the conclusion that aspirin was a product and Bayer was just one of many manufacturers.
So it's possible that someday the Microsoft Corporation will say, do your Googling on Bing.
Sure it is.
I don't know if I want to live in that world. It just... Jessica, thank you so much.
Sure thing.
Jessica Littman is a professor of law at the University of Michigan Brand Law School in Brand, Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Coming up, two OTM producers go all fanboy on their video game maker hero.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org, and the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Kickstarter is a crowdfunding website where people ask others to contribute money to their creative projects. Recently, game developer Tim Schafer shattered a Kickstarter record by attracting the most backers and raising the most money in 24 hours. Schafer also happens to be a demigod to two of our producers, Alex Goldman and PJ Vogt. PJ, Alex, who is this guy to you?
Tim Schafer was sort of the king of making these games that had incredible depth and incredible character. They were much more narrative. It was more about puzzle solving.
I feel like the best way to explain this is to just give you one puzzle from one of the games. There's this game called Day of the Tentacle, which is a Tim Schafer one. And you're these three time-traveling teenagers who have to save the world from a purple tentacle who's trying to take it over. One of the kids is in the future. She's in tentacle prison. So she has to pretend to be sick, steal a tentacle anatomical chart from the doctor's office, flush it into the past using the time-traveling porta-potty to the kid who's in 1776. He has to convince Betsy Ross to make the tentacle body the American flag so that she can, in the future, disguise as a tentacle using a flag and get out of jail. Does that make any sense?
Sort of.
All of his games have the same sort of lunatic sense of humor, but they weren't blockbusters. And the gaming industry figured out, much like the movie industry, how to make blockbusters. And the company that he worked for, LucasArts, once they started making games that were based on their hottest property, Star Wars, they basically never went back, and the point-and-click adventure was sort of lost to the sands of history.
So now we'll hear Tim Schafer talking to you guys about his effort to kick a game off on Kickstarter.
Yeah.
Immediately we saw that it had $30. Like, as soon as we refreshed it, we're like, that's interesting. And then I was thinking, I wonder how much it'll be before I go to bed tonight. If we hit $2,000, that would be exciting, because that would mean probably by the end of the 30 days, then we'll have our goal of $400,000. But we hit $400,000 before I went to sleep that night. And by the end of the project, it was about $3.3 million.
Whoa. I mean, have you had trouble with publishing in the past? Is this the culmination of sort of a long and storied issues with publishing?
Well, we have had good and bad experiences with publishers. I think the publishers are happy with the whole thing because this is a business they didn't want anyway. They didn't want to make this project. Because if you look at the number of backers, you know, 90,000 backers, that's not a lot for selling a game. Like, if we were to sell a game today and only 90,000 people bought it, it would be considered a failure. But they're giving money for a game that didn't even have a title yet, didn't even have a game design yet.
Are you giving people input on the shape of the game, or on, like, what it'll actually look like?
Yeah, we have this private. People can see we're going to put up early concept art and, you know, early gameplay notes. And some things we're even going to put up to a vote, maybe. Like, here's two possible ways this character could look. You know, how do you think it should look? We're definitely letting them participate.
Customers have a lot of nostalgia for the games you've made. And so it feels like if people were weighing in, they'd say, what we really want is, like, what we're used to. But part of the reason you've been really good at what you do is because you're surprising as a game maker. Are you worried that by opening up the process, you're going to sort of either frustrate people or be frustrated by people?
The big risk of including people in the process is they're going to see one of the scary things about doing creative work is that the creative work is not great the whole time. Games go through a long period where they're not fun. Right now, it's the perfect game. It is all things to all people because it doesn't exist yet. Some people wanted a game that was about cowboys, and we're going to make a game about frogs. That's not what we're doing, but you know what I mean? Like, it's going to be impossible to come up with one game that perfectly goes along with everyone's expectations.
Is it different pitching to the sort of like wide internet audience versus pitching to a publishing company?
Essentially, the pitch you're making when you pitch a publisher is a financial one. You're saying, here's my argument for why if you give me this many millions of dollars, I'll return 35 times that. That's really the calculation they're figuring out. If you're making a pitch to the fans, you're saying, hey, I'm going to do this creative thing that's going to be awesome, and who wants to help me? That's a very different, it's not even an argument. It's more just like an invitation to a party. Hey, who wants to come join this fun, happy party with me?
How do I put this delicately? Let's say that people don't like the game as much as you would like them to. Are you worried about the sustainability of this model in the future?
So you're saying if the Double Fine Adventure comes out and it's horrible, will that bring down Kickstarter?
I was trying to sugarcoat it a bit.
Is that what you're dancing around? Oh, we're taking everybody down with us. Kickstarter, Double Fine, On the Media, everyone. You know, my worst case scenario is actually not that a project will come out that'll be bad, but that someone might pull a con, essentially, and just take all the money and, oh, the game got canceled, or something right. weird like that, and just right. actually take the money. And I don't think that'll kill what's going on, because I think it's about reputation now. And anyone who pulls that kind of fraud on, you know, in a very public way won't be able to do it again.
Not only are your games set apart in terms of game mechanics in some ways, I mean, the subject matter of your games is so far afield. I mean, you know, psychic summer camps and Triumph Taverling tentacles and things. But what is it that you think resonates so much with people?
I think there is a contingent of people who love games but think they could be more. For me, that just means that we see games as art and we see that they could talk about any topic under the sun. I think games, especially mainstream games, have focused on what would be, if we were talking about movies, summer blockbuster action movies. That's what most games are. But when you see movies, there's a whole range of genres, and there's a movie for your grandma, and there's a movie for your mom and dad, there's a movie for the kids, and there's a movie about, you know, romance, and we just want games to go there. We want games to go into all these places that they haven't gone before.
I still think about those like LucasArts adventure games, and they have like a richness for me that a lot of fiction doesn't have, that most games I play, even if I really enjoy them, like certainly don't have. You don't always necessarily know why something you make that is good, but why do you think those felt richer?
Oh, you're asking him why he's so awesome.
Yeah, why are you so great?
I mean, can I turn that back on you? Do you have any idea why you like those games so much? I would love to know.
There were these really amazing worlds that they created. Growing up, I would read stuff like Pynchon or like David Foster Wallace, stuff that was absurdist. And it would remind me of those games, like that they felt blown out and funny, but with like real people in them. And Grim Fandango, like Jesus. Like I think about shots from that game. Like I think about when he's like mopping the cafe and there's like a crane shot and then it comes back and it's like a nightclub that he owns.
I think the games have the potential to be not just equal, but like one of the most powerful art forms out there because of the way that you feel invested in it, because you're in it. You are living in that world. There's a lot of power there that has not even fully been explored yet, you know, that you're transforming a player into an alternate state of mind, and that's a really powerful place to have somebody. You know, movies definitely transport you, but you're watching it in a passive way. If you can transport people to that other world and actually have them active in that world, that's has a potential to be much, much deeper, I think.
Tim Schafer is the founder of Double Fine Productions. Schafer's Kickstarter success has launched many many imitators, mostly unknowns, competing for the cash of game enthusiasts. In this crowded arena, a gaming website like rockpapershotgun.com can make or break a dream. John Walker is one of its editors. John, welcome to OTM.
Thank you.
Having myself plied in the thumbs-up, thumbs-down trade for about 25 years, it's no fun to think of the negative consequences it eats at you. How do you deal with the level of power that you do have?
You can't allow yourself to go into the place which says 150 people spent 3 years of their lives working their hearts out on this. They may lose their jobs if this game doesn't sell well. You can't let that get into your head, because then you're going to do a disservice to the people that you are working for. That's the readers. Your job is to inform the readers, is it worth spending my money on this particular product? And if you allow anything else to get in the way of that, then you're compromised.
There are many projects that go up on Kickstarter, but the only ones that seem to make it are those that get coverage by you or some of your competitors. Is that the way it should be?
That's a great question. Kickstarter is still a pretty new concept for funding gaming. I'd like to see a time where it develops its own depth of community such that there's enough people visiting Kickstarter every day to just find out what projects are there without needing our bringing attention to them.
List for me, please, the various ways in which developers try to bribe you.
It really just isn't a thing that I've experienced. 14 years doing this job, and I've never once even had the offer of bribery to turn down. You get sent some real strange crap in the post, but nothing that would influence you or make you want to change your opinion on a game.
Has there been an example of a game that you've written about positively, based on, you know, a few screen grabs of developing narratives, then seeing the game come to fruition only to find out that, oh man, this game sucks?
It's too early for that. This phenomenon is only a few months old, and so there hasn't been a development cycle that's got there yet. But the point you're making is really important. We are not saying go give your money to this just because we think it looks interesting. We're saying this looks interesting. You're an adult. You can go make your decision what you want to do with your money. Hopefully by the end of this year, the first famous Kickstarter projects will start to appear, and we're going to have some great ones, and we're going to have a really interesting situation where the first Kickstarter that's raised $500,000 makes something terrible. That's going to be a really interesting time, and I think that will probably hurt the whole project quite badly.
John, thank you very much.
That's a pleasure. It's great to speak to you.
John Walker is an editor of the gaming site rockpapershotgun.com. No one really knows what makes a game click. Tim Schafer's game attracted nearly 90,000 backers. Zynga, the leading Facebook gaming company, has some 240 million monthly active players logged into games that critics say do little more than suck money out of their pockets. One such critic, game designer Ian Bogost, figured the best way to slam these games would be to build a vicious parody of them. But despite his worst intentions, that's not how it played out, as OTM producer PJ Vogt reported last fall. Here's a replay.
Last summer, Cindy Barrett got hooked on this Facebook game. The way the game works, you get a point every time you click. Cindy was battling her brother Eric, who was routinely beating her.
At that point, I maybe had 10 clicks a week. My brother would always have 12 clicks, and it would make me frustrated. So I befriended the top clickers. They taught me how to get more clicks. Literally within a day, I had something like 200 clicks. And I was like, hey, Eric, is there any way you can compete with me? Because I think at that point he had 6. And it just went downhill from there.
The game is called Cow Clicker. It's the work of a video game designer named Ian Bogost. Bogost creations are usually more like art than entertainment. People don't typically get hooked on them. Bogost hates popular social networking video games. Games like Farmville that clog your Facebook newsfeed with notifications about how your aunt just harvested her virtual crops or your dad put out a hit on a mob boss. He decided the best way to criticize those games would be to make the dumbest one he could imagine. That was Cow Clicker, the game Cindy found. The reductio ad absurdum of Facebook games.
You know, a game in which all you do is click on a cow and that's it. Maybe you pay for the privilege to click on a cow.
You click your cow, it moves. Wait 6 hours and you can click it again. Or you can get virtual money, either through clicks or by spending real cash that you spend to reset the timer and immediately click again.
People took notice. The media took notice.
Leah Alexander is a game journalist who's also friends with Boghost. She wrote about CalClicker for the website Kotaku.
He was in every gaming magazine and some non-gaming magazines regarding CalClicker. It was much more popular than I think he had ever predicted it would be.
Game journalists liked CalClicker because they got the joke. And as more players poured in, Boghost was surprised to find himself feeling pretty proud.
Gleeful. I mean, when people play your game, you can't help but feel pleasure. That's what you want. And I did feel that way for some time, especially when, you know, there was a relatively even distribution of different kinds of reactions.
The resulting buzz brought in more players, but most of them weren't in on the joke.
Somewhere along the line, his larger user base began to be people who either they understood it was a joke and they still enjoyed it, or they just didn't get it, or they just didn't care. Like, people really loved their cows.
50,000 people. For many of them, CalClicker was just another mindless, addictive Facebook game, indistinguishable from the mindless, addictive games it was meant to parody.
The ironist players dropped off. What I was left with were real players who were making demands, you know, who wanted things that I wasn't giving them in the game. They wanted different cows. They wanted, like, Cthulhu.
Wait, Cthulhu?
Yeah, they wanted a Lovecraftian Cthulhu cow, Cthulhu.
That's the bovine equivalent of a tentacled creature named Cthulhu, created by H.P. Lovecraft and beloved by geeks. Still psyched that people were into his game, Boghost gave them what they wanted.
You know, it was a pirate cow, a ninja cow, and a cow that cost over $100. When you bought that cow, we sent a real cow to the third world, you know. I was very eager to put more material into the game to see how people would react.
But eventually, he got uneasy.
After a while, I realized they're doing exactly what concerned me about these games. They were, you know, becoming compulsively attached to it. There was one point when I realized that I was now attached to it in a compulsive way. I was worrying about what the cow clickers thought while I was away from the game. And that was the moment at which I both felt kind of empathy with the players, and also I began to feel very disturbed by the product.
He decided to sabotage the game, to tweak it, to make it more maddening, more dumb.
At one point, he took the default cow, switched it to face the other direction, and charged $20 for it. And people bought it.
Boghost couldn't diminish people's love for CalClicker. The game generated its own fan culture.
CalClicker poetry, silkscreen printed t-shirts. There was this woman who did these sort of CalClicker portraits of all her CalClicker friends.
Boghost decided that if he couldn't ruin CalClicker, he'd kill it. He got in touch with friends across the world, and he had them hide clues in the real world for CalClicker diehards to find. Once assembled, the clues spelled out a chilling prophecy.
Cowpocalypse. And then there was this timer that started running, and if the timer ended, then, you know, the game would shut down. At least that was the implication. I never really said what would happen.
In a final twist of perversity, Boghost designed his game-ending countdown clock to speed up whenever anyone played the game, and to reset if people paid money.
I wanted the players to feel like they were accelerating their own demise by playing and then be tempted to maybe purchase their way out of it. And several people, like, extended the clock at the very last minute a few times.
When you create something, you don't get to decide how it'll be received. Ian Boghost's game wasn't designed to be enjoyable, but it turned out to be possibly the most resonant game he's ever made. His take on what that might mean is actually pretty optimistic.
It shows us how weird and complicated simple things really are, and shows me not that, like, I'm some sort of brilliant designer who made this thing that was bigger than I thought it was, but how resilient and creative people are. I did this thing that was CalClicker, and in spite of it, they rose above and made it something more than it really was.
That's one way to look at it. Here's another. You remember that countdown clock?
When the clock finally counted down to zero, there was a cow rapture.
Here's how the cowpocalypse actually transpired.
All of the cows were whisked away, and all that was left were the little shadows where they had been standing. But the game continued to run, and in fact, the game continues to run to this day. And there are still people clicking on the spot where a cow used to be.
Boghost still gets messages from confused cow clickers. A typical complaint, which Lee Alexander, the video game journalist, published, read that after the rapture, CalClicker was, quote, not a very fun game any longer. Boghost answered, "It wasn't very fun before." For Boghost, CowClicker was never about fun. It was a joke. But as it turned out, the joke was on him. For On the Media, I'm PJ Vogt.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Louisa Beck and Rob Schoon. Thanks, Louisa and Rob, for all your help, and best of luck with everything. And the show is edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson, and our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.